Today is Thursday, April 12th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president tweets an attack on Syria could be imminent.
We're continuing to look at a number of options.
A top member of the president's party says he's retiring. A final farewell to Winnie Mandela. Also ahead, a look at some of the latest big movies. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the World Health Organization said Wednesday about 500 people went to health facilities with signs and symptoms consistent with exposure to toxic chemicals after suspected poison gas and a poison gas attack in the Syrian rebel-held enclave just before it fell. Syria's envoy rejects what it calls baseless allegations. Wednesday, President Trump tweeted a warning that missiles will be coming and lambasted Moscow for standing with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Secretary of State Jim Mattis, speaking Wednesday from the Pentagon, said there hasn't yet been a definitive determination of who is responsible for the chemical attack.
We're still assessing the intelligence, ourselves and our allies. We're still working on this.
Is the U.S. military ready right now to conduct a retaliatory strike if ordered?
We stand ready to provide military options if they're appropriate, as the president determined.
Joining us to further discuss what this all will mean is Mark Rozelle, Dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Well, the president's reaction on Twitter, what about what the U.S. will do has certainly rattled some nerves.
It was not only a provocative tweet by the president, but it also went against something he has said in the past, which is that a responsible president does not signal his military intentions ahead of time. And that's what the president has done here. He's telling exactly what he supposedly is planning to do. Whether this is a kind of head fake tactic and he's trying to create some kind of anxiety here among the Russians and see what kind of reaction he can get, I just don't know. He's a very unpredictable guy, as we all know. But it's very much outside the norm of presidential discourse and diplomacy for a president of the United States to issue a statement like that on social media without the guidance or intervention in any way of his key staff. And apparently, in this case, he completely surprised key staff who had no idea that this was coming.
And what does it tell you about Russia's response that they will retaliate if the U.S. were to take action with strikes in Syria?
Well, I think Russia's response is entirely predictable. The president has posed a very provocative challenge, and they're not going to lose face and simply back down in direct response to a presidential threat on social media. Now, that's worrisome because that is how wars sometimes start, when two sides provoke each other with words in a way that causes somebody to feel you cannot back down. You have to show how tough you are. That's what worries a lot of people right now. At a time when you need cooler heads to prevail, some form of diplomacy, discussion, even just getting the facts as to what exactly did happen. I think most of us believe that we know what happened, but still, one would expect that there be an effort to try to gather more information before acting so precipitously like this.
So given these circumstances and the fact that the president, just prior to this chemical attack, had said that he wanted out of Syria, he wanted U.S. troops out of Syria, that also surprised some of the military and his national security team, because they were sort of saying things that contradicted that the mission isn't finished yet. What kind of powers does the president have to make these decisions by himself as far as whether or not the U.S. goes to war in a situation like this?
The president believes he has the authority to act unilaterally under his Article 2 powers of the presidency, and that there are no constitutional or any other restrictions on his authority to act. And I would argue that that's just constitutionally wrong. The founders of our republic put into place a document that restricted the war power primarily to the legislative branch. And in the modern era, the presidential war power is understood as being restricted to cases of either congressional declaration, which happens almost never now, right, or congressional authorization of the use of force. And without a direct congressional authorization, I don't believe that the president has the constitutional authority to act unilaterally. But the problem is Congress has to challenge the president. The president says he has that authority and he begins to take action. It is up to Congress to step forward and to demand that the president respect its constitutional role in our system of separated powers, and that Congress first be given the opportunity to provide authorization and ultimately appropriation of funding for any military action, and that the president has to wait for those things to happen. But for the most part, members of Congress are largely deferential to the president when the president determines that the United States has to engage in military action. And so the Constitution says one thing, Congress is authorized to take the lead here, but many members of Congress see the president as having the ultimate authority.
I've heard some experts say, too, that the U.S. needs to be pretty careful about getting itself into yet another conflict without a goal and an end game, or we might end up being drawn into something for years and years again.
That's really curious, because the president himself, as a presidential candidate in 2016, remember, was harshly critical of the former Bush administration for having gotten the United States involved in the Middle East wars without a longer strategy or consideration of what the overriding American interests are in that region and how we can get our troops out of there with some definition of success. And Mr. Trump was perhaps the most outspoken among the Republican candidates in the presidential primaries against the Bush administration Middle East wars. And now, of course, the president is threatening to make military strikes. He made military strikes in Syria last year without any direct congressional authorization or consent to take military action. And now he's threatening to do the same. And he's claiming, as some of his predecessors, who he previously criticized, as having the authority to act completely on his own without any checks on his power whatsoever. So what the president is claiming he has the right to do today and the potential for the United States to get involved in a long, drawn-out military conflict are very much in opposition to positions that he had taken as a presidential candidate, where many times he seemed like the most anti-war Republican in all of those presidential debates during the primary season.
That's Mark Rozelle. Sorry, Mark, Dean of the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Thank you so much for your perspective. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The daughter of a poisoned spy in Britain rejects Russian help. Farmers fret over Trump's trade tactics. Former Mexican president backs opium poppy legalization. And Miami is gaining popularity as a major birth tourism destination. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Speaker of the House of Representatives Paul Ryan has announced that he will not seek re-election for his House seat this November, raising questions about Republicans' ability to maintain control of the House after the midterm elections.
The announcement Wednesday did not come as a complete surprise. Rumors that Ryan had been thinking about retirement have been swirling for months. Ryan has served as a congressman from Wisconsin for 20 years and took over as Speaker and leader of the House Republican Conference in 2015 after then-Speaker John Boehner stepped down. President Donald Trump, with whom Ryan has had a tense relationship at times, praised the Speaker on Twitter, calling him a good man whose legacy of achievement cannot be questioned. In making the announcement, Ryan said the November elections were not a factor in his decision.
Look, you all know me. I didn't take this job to get the gavel in the first place. I'm not a guy who thinks about it like that. This really was two things. I have accomplished much of what I came here to do, and my kids aren't getting any younger. And if I stay, they're only going to know me as a weekend dad, and that's just something I consciously can't do. And that's really it right there.
The speaker vowed to continue to work on entitlement reform during the remainder of his time in office. Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi issued a statement commending Ryan for his steadfast commitment to our country and expressed hope both parties will work constructively during his remaining time in Congress. Jeff Custer, VOA News, Washington.
Well, tensions remain high on the Gaza Strip, where nine Palestinians, including a journalist, died after being shot by Israeli troops during border clashes last Friday. Yasser Murtagha, a photographer with the Gaza-based Ayn Media Agency, was hit during the clashes despite wearing a press vest. The Israeli military said shots were fired only at instigators who were involved in attacks on the troops. Israel's defense minister then this week said that the well-known journalist was a member of Hamas, an allegation denied by the militant group and the journalist's family. Joining us now is Sharif Mansour, Middle East and North Africa program coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. What can you tell us about what you know?
He was wearing a press mark vest on his chest while covering the protest on Friday. He was shot in the abdomen. He was taken from the scene and medicated, operated on for 4 hours until he was announced dead in a Gaza hospital. He is one of the journalists who was assaulted that day by Israeli defense forces. He was shot in the abdomen, but others were shot as well. At least 5 other journalists were injured while covering the protest on April 6th.
Were they all from the same news organization? Where were they from?
They were from various other local outlets, including some Hamas-affiliated, like Al-Aqsa TV, camera person Khalil Abu Adaira. There was also freelance journalists and other who work for the independent news agency Sky Press Agency.
Why were the shots fired, and why were they aimed at journalists, or were they caught in the crossfire? What do you know about what happened?
What we know is that, at least for the case of Yasser, he was at least 200, 300 feet away from the fence where Israeli officers were located, of other civilians or Israeli military officers. We also have seen a report from statements by IDF saying that they have not targeted journalists and they are opening an investigation. However, we are very concerned about statements by the Israeli defense minister who suggested that the journalist might have been targeted because he was operating a drone. At least 3 eyewitnesses told Reuters that he was not operating a drone at the time he was shot. But also, we don't think that's a justification, because the same journalist, have operated drones in the past. And this was mainly a protest that had huge number. Many people would have liked to show the number of protests. This is a legitimate journalist work.
What does your organization do in a situation like this when you're made aware of these things?
We've documented the case. We sent inquiries to Israeli officials, and we are planning to follow up with specific questions demanding evidence, if any, that justify Israeli military officers or Israeli military soldiers' actions against the journalist, including Yasser Murtagha. And we're hoping to document all of this and raise it directly with Israeli officials later in the year.
There were some claims that these weren't actually journalists. Have you heard that?
Not on this case. We have documented record of Yasser on our website, his work in covering past demonstrations, and his freelance work in reporting as a cameraman. It's important to know that journalists are civilians, and it is the duty of security forces on either side of the fence to make sure that they operate safely, and if there was any violation, those violations must be thoroughly investigated and not be left to the ordinary response of pledging to make probes of the killing without arriving to a conclusion. We've seen same pledges by Israeli officials since the Gaza war, and the Israeli government's own controller has said last month that those investigations have been delayed without conclusion.
That's Sharif Mansour, Middle East and North Africa Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Thank you for being with us. The recent death of South African icon Winnie Mandela at the age of 81 has awakened memories of the long struggle to end apartheid and achieve equality in the Rainbow Nation. Tributes from top South Africans at her memorial service Wednesday didn't shy away from her controversial past, even as they underscored the continued importance of her struggle. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Glory, glory, glory. Winnie Madikizela Mandela, the South African icon who fought tirelessly, visibly, and at great personal cost to bring racial equality to South Africa, is being celebrated with vows that her struggle will continue. Wednesday's somber memorial in Johannesburg was the culmination of at least a dozen memorials held across the nation since her April 2nd death at the age of 81. Madikizela Mandela, a lifelong activist who served in Parliament for nearly two decades, was the second wife of Nelson Mandela, the man seen as the leader of the anti-apartheid struggle, who went on to become South Africa's first black president. The two divorced in 1996 after 38 years of marriage, most of it spent apart during his 27-year term in prison. President Cyril Ramaphosa, who will deliver the eulogy at her state funeral on Saturday, vowed to continue her legacy during a memorial Tuesday in her rural hometown.
Whilst we mourn Umama Winnie for her passing away, we are also here to celebrate her life because it was a life that was well-lived and selflessly dedicated to the improvement of the conditions of others.
Many South Africans, like struggle veteran Kingsley Makubela, regard Madikizela Mandela as a maternal figure. Makubela spent 9 years in exile as a member of the banned African National Congress and aide to leader Oliver Tambo. When he returned to South Africa in 1990, she cleared a room for him in her Soweto home.
She was like a mother figure to me. When I came back from exile, I lived with her in her house. And anyone that she regarded as a family, myself included, very protective. So that's how she was as a person.
But she paid a price for her activism, including an 18-month stint in solitary confinement and banishment to a rural town. She was also convicted of kidnapping and being an accessory to assault in the 1989 killing of a 14-year-old anti-apartheid activist who she suspected of being a police informer. Madikizela Mandela's bodyguard was convicted in Stompie Moeketsi's murder. Her death has invigorated the ANC Women's League, which Madikizela Mandela led for 10 years. On Wednesday, many women in the crowd at Orlando Stadium in Soweto wore duks, a traditional South African head wrap often worn by Madikizela Mandela. Daughter of slain anti-apartheid activist Chris Hani, Lindiwe Hani, said she helped empower South Africa's women.
There have been so many things said about Umama Winnie this week that honestly I have found quite unpalatable. Whether it's in the media or leaders, even by those that feel they are defending her, Umama Winnie does not need defending. Her actions are the reason that I can stand here as an independent, strong, and unapologetic black woman. Not only did she keep the home fires burning, she collected the wood and she lit that fire. She was fearless.
As the ANC said in a statement, Winnie Madikizela Mandela did not die. She multiplied. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari says he will seek his party's presidential ticket to contest elections in February 2019, ending months of speculation about his future. The future of 75-year-old Muhammadu Buhari on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
This is Russ Davis, and in April, Jazz Appreciation Month, as part of our celebration on the Next Jazz America, we'll celebrate the 78th birthday on Thursday, April 12th, of one of the living legends, the great NEA jazz master keyboardist Herbie Hancock. We'll celebrate him on the Next Jazz America.
VOA's International Edition continues now as we take a look at some of the new movies out of Hollywood. And for that, we're joined by Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. So, Jeff, this first movie, at first I was intrigued because, you know, I love animals and it's all about a mountain gorilla, but I see it's not exactly a warm and cuddly movie.
Well, actually, it's an albino gorilla named George. And the way the story goes is that, you know, The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, is a primatologist, and he found this baby gorilla. He was also part of the Special Forces in the Army. So he was, defending wildlife in Africa against poachers, and he found the baby albino gorilla, took it back to the San Diego Zoo, and started raising it and teaching it sign language. It's based on the 1980s game Rampage, where they're genetically modified, and they keep, to be weapons, and they keep growing and growing and growing. So the experiment's in outer space. It crashes to Earth. You know, the gorilla touches it. Also, a wolf in Montana touches it. And also, a crocodile in the Florida Everglades. So all of them start growing supersized proportions. And The Rock is trying to prevent these creatures from destroying Chicago. I know, this is a crazy premise. So there's just over and over again, massive destruction, massive action sequences. They just exhaust every kind of action and monster movie cliche, and it just doesn't work for me. It really doesn't. It was overwhelming. It was bloated.
Okay, and then you've got a horror, and you know how I feel about horrors. Life is scary enough, but okay, let's talk about it. A Quiet Place?
This was a big hit at the South by Southwest Film Festival a few weeks ago, about a month ago. And it's from director John Krasinski, who you probably know from The Office and the comedy show. And also his real-life wife, Emily Blunt, plays his wife in the movie. And there's these creatures that are hunting human beings. I think they came from outer space. They don't make it too clear where they came from, but there was some sort of invasion that happened. And we don't know the backstory of it, because the movie starts like 90 days into the invasion. And this family's living out in the wild, and we find out that if they hear you, they hunt you. They can't see, but they have this incredible sense of hearing, and they're also these vicious alien-like monsters. So here's this family trying to survive. Well, you can't make any noise whatsoever. And usually in horror films, the use of sound is pretty important, but here's a movie where literally they don't say hardly any dialogue during the movie. In fact, they use sign language, and one of the teenage girls in the family is Millie Simmons, who was in Wonderstruck last year. She's a deaf actress, so she's even in more peril when she can't hear these creatures or if a sound happens. So the entire movie, as the audience kind of calms down the first 30 minutes and the restlessness happens, you get into the psyche where a sound happens, people freak out, because you can't look at the movie through your fingers like normally do and hear a movie going on. You've got to use your ears. So it's such a unique concept. It works on every level. It was made for a paltry $15 million. It's already grossed $60-70 million. It's on its way to becoming one of the most successful horror thrill films. And it was a great time. You just felt the synergy with the audience. All these foreshadowing going on, because these creatures are terrifying. They show up at a moment's notice. They're vicious. They're scary looking. Things that are nightmares are made of. And I had a great time with it. I really did. This is a fun date movie. And this is an exceptional thriller. This is so much fun.
All right, Jeffrey K. Howard. Find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. And finally, two rappers are teaming up for a new single, and VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London talks about it with International Edition's Sarah Williams.
We have a brand new song from a very popular artist who has delayed the release of his sophomore album not once, not twice, but three times. Finally, he announced his new release date is April 27th. I'm talking about Post Malone. Post Malone is the singer who gave us such hits as White Iverson in 2015. 2016, he gave us Congratulations. And then 2017, he put out a song that was number one for quite a few weeks. It was number one in 15 countries and has over 25 million streams, the song Rockstar with 21 Savage. Well, Post Malone is back, and he's got a brand new song, which we're going to check out today off the upcoming album. Let's listen to Psycho.
Damn, I ain't pick on psycho. Lil' mama bad like Michael. Can't really trust nobody with all this jewelry on you. My roof look like a no-show. Got diamonds by the bolo. Don't act like you my friend when I'm rolling through my hands. Oh, they be going psycho. My rollie going crazy.
So Post Malone has some help on this new latest single.
One of the things he's doing on his newest album, he is doing a lot of collaborations. The last big hit, Rockstar, was with 21 Savage. His new song, which we just checked out, Psycho, features Ty Dolla $ign, who's another well-established rap artist. So you got two rap guys kind of going at it with each other in the song Psycho. It's a cool song. I like the song.
How is Psycho different from Rockstar?
So, yeah, one of the ways that this song is different is that he likes to team up with different singers and include different singers. On his last song is 21 Savage. He's had a few different guests on his music, which is consistent throughout the entire new album, which is called Beer Bongs and Bentleys.
What a title.
A very interesting title. His second CD coming out April 27th. Interesting story. There's been a YouTube hacker who came on YouTube this past week and started taking people's videos off. One of the people that he targeted was Post Malone. Post Malone's videos were removed from YouTube by this hacker. They did finally catch up with the hacker, and they were able to restore the videos. Now, his real name is not Post Malone. It's Austin Post. And he took the name Malone from Karl Malone, who's a legendary NBA basketball superstar from the 70s and 80s. He taught himself to play guitar when he was about 11 years old on the video game Guitar Hero. Post Malone, interesting guy, he's got tattoos all over his body. And it was just revealed he's got a tattoo of John F. Kennedy, because he's a big supporter, big fan of John F. Kennedy and his presidency. And also, on a totally opposite spectrum, he's got a tattoo of Justin Bieber on his butt. Now, I don't know why, what made him decide to do that, but he decided to do that. Post Malone is one of the headliners for this coming up weekend's Coachella Valley Music Festival, which we all know is headlined by The Weeknd and Beyonce. But Post Malone will be performing there as well in the California desert. The new album is called Beer Bongs and Bentleys. It's his second album. Most importantly, the fourth release date now for this album is April 27th.
All right. Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $10 million for information leading to the identification or location of Muhammad al-Jolani, leader of the Al-Nusra Front, or ANF, terrorist group. This is the first Rewards for Justice reward offer for a leader of al-Nusra Front, the Syrian branch of al-Qaeda. In 2013, al-Jolani pledged allegiance to al-Qaeda and its leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, after he had a public falling out with ISIS. In 2016, in a video posted online, al-Jolani praised al-Qaeda and al-Zawahiri and claimed the ANF was changing its name to Jabhat Fath al-Sham. Under al-Jolani's leadership, ANF has carried out multiple terrorist attacks throughout Syria, often targeting civilians. In April 2015, ANF reportedly kidnapped and later released approximately 300 Kurdish civilians from a checkpoint in Syria. In June 2015, ANF claimed responsibility for the massacre of 20 residents in a Druze village in Idlib province, Syria. In January 2017, ANF merged with several other hardline opposition groups to form Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. ANF remains al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, and Jolani remains the leader of ANF, which is at the core of HTS. In 2014, ANF was designated as a foreign terrorist organization by the State Department. The same year, the UN added ANF to its sanctions list. Since its inception in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. For more information about al-Jolani, go to www.rewardsforjustice.net. We encourage anyone with information about al-Jolani to contact the Rewards for Justice office via email on the website, info@rewardsforjustice.net, by phone 1-800-877-3927 in North America, or by mail, Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303
USA. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.